A look at what went wrong for Israel in Gaza.
There were definitely some lessons learned in both the counterterrorism space and the counterinsurgency space. Those have not, from my perspective, have not necessarily been integrated into Israeli Defense Force operations.
Plus, the United States and Ukraine to sign a security agreement.
Ukrainians fear this could become a short-term agreement as the chances of Donald Trump returning to the White House remain high, and his previous statements suggested he could consider a different approach in relation to the Russia-Ukraine war.
And later, 9 dead in Russian shelling in southern Ukraine, Russian warships pull into Havana, and the latest from Tbilisi. Today is Thursday, June 13th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. What went wrong in Israel's war against Hamas? Were there lessons from previous urban battles against insurgent groups that went unheeded? Would it have made a difference? I'm joined by Karen Sudkamp. She's a national security researcher with the RAND Corporation.
So the premise of the article was, after spending 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan and conducting the war on terror, that there were definitely some lessons learned in both the counterterrorism space and the counterinsurgency space. Those have not, from my perspective, have not necessarily been integrated into Israeli Defense Force operations.
Well, what are those lessons?
So, you know, primarily it starts, you know, from the top of having a lack of a firm strategy and clear objectives. Destroying a terrorist group is not a specific or clear objective, particularly one like Hamas that is so integrated into society and governance and economics and the entire daily life in Gaza in particular.
So what would you suggest Israel do differently?
You know, if you look at, you know, operations in not only Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria, in the places where the United States had the most success was when a multifaceted campaign was undertaken. So not just conducting strategic strikes and killing or capturing terrorist organization leaders, but also working to ensure that the civilian population was taken care of, that civilian infrastructure was preserved to ensure reconstruction and rebuilding.
Is this the sort of hearts and minds stuff we've been reading about?
Definitely more on the hearts and minds stuff, but on the hearts and minds side of it all, but also just the general recognition that not, you know, just because you're a Palestinian in Gaza, for example, does not automatically assume that you are supportive of Hamas, and the civilians aren't automatically guilty or should be paying for the poor decisions of Hamas.
Now, an example of something that Israel has done right, which you point out in your article, is the sort of targeted attack in Lebanon recently to get that one senior Hezbollah official.
Right.
Is it practical to do a whole war with such resource-intensive, precise strikes like that? Could they prosecute the whole war in Gaza that way?
I think ultimately it comes back to what are your goals and strategies. And when you have a broad, ill-defined goal of destroying Hamas, all-encompassing, viewing the attacks of October 7th and the response as an existential threat, it seems as though the response is to respond in such a way with overwhelming force to completely destroy that existential threat. You know, the United States has spent a lot of time on those exquisite terrorist strikes against senior leaders, but it's also paired with, as you mentioned, the Hearts and Minds campaign, the working with, you know, local partners and protecting to the fullest extent possible civilian life and civilian infrastructure.
Along with the military shortcomings of Israel's operation in Gaza, it's pretty clear there are humanitarian problems as well. Famine is imminent. The healthcare system is almost non-functioning. How should or how can Israel respond to that? What's their responsibility?
Well, in this instance, I believe the answer to this is yes. For decades, at this point, Israel has controlled access to the Gaza Strip, humanitarian aid, food, medicine, et cetera, in and out, and has severely limited access over the course of roughly 8 months at this point. And so when thinking about the long-term goals, that is also a very important element of ensuring that harm is limited to the civilian population. And honestly, as you mentioned, you know, Hearts and Minds, it goes a long way to ensure that people are healthy and fed and have homes to return to, quite honestly.
That's Karen Sudkamp of the RAND Corporation. Ms. Sudkamp, thanks very much for your analysis today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Among other things that might have gone wrong in Israel's war on Hamas is that many of the hostages taken on October 7th are still in captivity. Relatives of the hostages joined demonstrators gathered in Tel Aviv on Wednesday night to demand the Israeli government accept a deal to bring them home, carrying banners reading, "Human life has no price," and "Deal now." Dozens gathered in the streets of Tel Aviv after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said mediators would keep working to get a ceasefire deal agreed to. Shahar Morzahiro's uncle is currently being held captive in Gaza.
I hope that for this time won't be a disappointment like last time and the time before that. We already had like 6 or 7 cycles of hope and despair and hope and despair. But what can we do? We are clinging on to any hope there is.
Hamas is believed to be holding around 80 hostages, as well as the remains of another 40. Miriam Schlein was also at the rally. She echoes the opinion that a ceasefire deal is what's needed to secure the release of the hostages.
I think that's the only way that there's going to be a deal is if there's going to be external pressure, especially from the United States putting pressure, then we have to get to a deal. The hostages have to be released as soon as possible.
And negotiations for that deal are ongoing. The United States is still pushing a plan, said to be an Israeli plan, though they have yet to publicly accept it. The U.S. National Security Advisor met with reporters on Thursday. Kylie Vaughn gets us up to speed.
On Tuesday, Hamas responded to the ceasefire proposal with amendments to the plan outlined by President Biden in late May. United States National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke with reporters in Italy on Thursday. He said some amendments were minor and not unanticipated, while others were more major and are not consistent with what Biden laid out or what the UN Security Council embraced.
But our goal is to figure out how we work to bridge the remaining gaps and get to a deal. So we're going to work with Qatar and Egypt. Qatar and Egypt will work with Hamas. Qatar, Egypt, and the United States will work with Israel. And the goal is to try to bring this to a conclusion as rapidly as possible.
Although the Israeli government has not officially announced its initial acceptance of the proposal, Sullivan emphasized Israel is on board.
To this day, they stand behind the proposal that was put on the table in late May that President Biden described in his May 31st speech. So I don't think that there is a contradiction in the Israeli position. I do think Hamas's assertion that they've accepted that proposal to the extent that they are saying that publicly is not correct. What they have done is responded to that proposal with an amended proposal.
Sullivan said it's difficult to provide a timeline to when or if the ceasefire will be accepted, but he remains optimistic. Kylie Vaughn, VOA News.
Changing gears now at the G7 summit in Italy. U.S. President Joe Biden will sign a new security agreement with Ukraine on Thursday evening after this show is recorded. The deal pledges America's long-term support to Kyiv, a top U.S. official said. Reuters' Gabe Singer has more.
The president on Wednesday departed for Italy on Air Force One for his meeting with leaders of the Group of Seven democracies. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters on the flight the agreement would make clear that U.S. support for Ukraine would, quote, last long into the future, particularly in the defense and security space. Sullivan added the pact will include a commitment to working with the U.S. Congress on funding Ukraine going forward, but will not commit to using U.S. forces on the ground. The White House had said earlier that Biden will meet again with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the summit. G7 leaders will address multiple challenges during the June 13th to 15th meeting. They include wars in Ukraine and the Middle East, trade imbalances with China, threats posed by artificial intelligence, and development challenges in Africa. Shoring up funding for Ukraine will be a top priority. U.S. and European officials are eager to lock in solutions ahead of a possible Trump re-election and the uncertainty it would raise over future U.S. support for Kyiv. Sullivan said the U.S. is, quote, making good progress on an innovative plan to use Russian assets frozen in the West to provide Ukraine with a large upfront loan to secure Kyiv's financing for 2025. Biden will press other G7 leaders to agree to using some $281 billion of Russian central bank funds to back up a $50 billion loan to Ukraine.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us. And not surprisingly, the security agreement with the United States is on the mind of Ukrainians, too. This as 9 people were killed in overnight shelling. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
Late on Wednesday, the Russian forces launched a missile attack on the city of Kryvyi Rih in Ukraine's south. An administrative building and a residential apartment building were heavily damaged. At least 9 people were killed and 32 injured, including 5 children. Some wounded remain in critical condition. Oleksandr Vilkul, the head of the Kryvyi Rih Defense Council, declared Friday as a day of mourning. Also, on Wednesday evening, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky arrived on an unannounced visit to Saudi Arabia. There, Zelensky confirmed that he held a meeting with His Highness the Crown Prince, Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud. The two leaders discussed bilateral relations and the effective ongoing cooperation between the countries. Zelensky also confirmed that preparations for the Global Peace Summit, its expected results and their positive implementation, and the approach to real peace for Ukraine were also discussed. Saudi Arabia has not yet confirmed whether it will attend the summit. Saudi Arabia maintains ties with both Moscow and Kyiv after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. At the same time, the Saudis position themselves as possible mediators in this war. Meanwhile, on Thursday, all eyes in Ukraine are on the G7 summit, where President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden to sign a bilateral security agreement. Jake Sullivan, U.S. President's National Security Advisor, confirmed that the agreement will clearly state that U.S. support for Ukraine will be long-term and guarantee cooperation in the areas of defense and security. He also said that the signing of the agreement is a clear signal to Russia that the Ukrainian international coalition is strong. While in Ukraine the security agreement with the U.S. is considered a very positive sign, it will not be ratified by Congress, meaning that any future president of the United States will be able to withdraw from it at any time. Ukrainians fear this could become a short-term agreement, as the chances of Donald Trump returning to the White House remain high, and his previous statements suggested he could consider a different approach in relation to the Russia-Ukraine war than the Biden administration has. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A follow-up on the protests in Tbilisi in a moment. Now, though, a story about Russia, the U.S., and Cuba. It's all very reminiscent of 1962 in the Cold War. Ricardo Marquina has the story, narrated for us today by Jonathan Speer.
Ships of the Russian Navy enter the port of Havana, Among them, the frigate Gorshkov and the nuclear submarine Kazan stand out. The Russian Ministry of Defense assures that none of these warships carry nuclear weapons, and that this visit does not pose a threat to anyone. Observers see this as a Kremlin attempt to show the world that Russia has allies in Latin America. Mathieu Buleg, a consulting fellow with the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House, spoke to VOA.
In the context of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, it does add an extra layer of provocation, a little bit of muscle flexing to show specifically now that Russia is not alone, is not isolated in the international community, and can still operate with other powers, militarily speaking, and demonstrate presence, force, and deployments.
But in the current atmosphere of tension between Russia and the West, Washington does not see this as a routine visit, and observers are watching closely, especially after US President Joe Biden approved Ukraine's use of American weapons against targets inside Russian territory. Some Western security analysts say that in any case, the physical threat posed by the Russian Navy in these waters is minimal. Siddharth Karshal is a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London.
Yeah, the ability of the Russian Navy to maintain any kind of competitive posture against the US Navy, particularly at this sort of distance in the United States' own backyard, is limited to the extreme in any kind of war-fighting context.
The arrival of Russian warships in Havana recalls the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the United States and the Soviet Union were on the brink of a nuclear confrontation. Philip Brenner is an emeritus professor of international relations and history at American University in Washington.
We came closer than ever to blowing up the world, because the United States was not aware that the Soviets had actually brought the warheads for the missiles into the island.
More than a show of force this time, analysts see Moscow as sending a message that in the face of growing international isolation, it still has friends in the far reaches of the world. For Ricardo Marquina, Jonathan Speer, VOA News.
And another story of Russia's foreign influence. In recent weeks, thousands of people have taken to the streets of the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, to protest against a new foreign agent law, which critics have complained is similar to legislation in Russia. The law is now in force, but its opponents have vowed to continue their demonstrations until crucial elections scheduled later this year. Henry Ridgewell reports from Tbilisi.
This is David Katsarava, a prominent anti-Russian protester in Georgia, attending a demonstration against the foreign agent law on May 14th. He says he was severely beaten five times during his detention, suffering injuries that require surgery. He was later released and has not been charged with any crime. He told VOA that the protests must go on and he will rejoin them in the coming days.
We have now the changed reality and we must continue fighting. Georgia has changed and changed its direction to Russia. We must fight until to the end, because otherwise if we stop, if we will be scared and will stay at home, that will be a finish for Free Georgia.
The new law requires any organization receiving more than 20% funding from overseas to register as a foreign agent. Critics have compared it to similar Russian legislation. Freedom India is among the Georgian lawmakers who supported the bill. He said it doesn't make any sense why the state budget should be transparent, but any funding from foreign sources should not be transparent in the same way. The European Union warns the law is incompatible with Georgia's EU membership aspirations. The United States has imposed sanctions on some Georgian lawmakers. The law is now in force, but its opponents say it's just the first battle. Giga Bokeria is chairman of the European Georgia Party.
We have elections in October. This protest will continue until then. And our goal will be, just like 30 years ago, to achieve a fundamental change. And this fundamental change is to remove the government, which is a proxy of the of the enemy of our sovereignty and enemy of our liberty inside the country.
The protesters say they will not give up. Elena Ramishvili is one of them.
No matter that the law is already in place, we keep on protesting because we want that Europe see our approaches and they support us.
Protester Georgi Japiashvili.
There's a big chance that they will also try to get the fake results of the elections, and we'll have to be ready for the action in case this happens.
Polls conducted before the foreign agent law suggest around 80% of Georgians support EU membership. The protests that were first triggered by the foreign agent law have changed into anti-government demonstrations. The question is whether this will build into a force powerful enough to change Georgia's future direction when voters cast their ballots in October this year. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Tbilisi.
The United Nations Refugee Agency warned on Thursday that without major geopolitical changes, the already staggering number of refugees worldwide could rise. Devi Rajaram of Reuters has that story.
Some 117 million people were forcibly displaced by the end of 2023, marking the highest number on record, according to the latest statistics from the United Nations Refugee Agency. Speaking earlier this week, the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said the number of forcibly displaced people has been increasing every year for the past 12 years.
The last figure that we have been sharing with you, if you recall, was 114 million. So we estimate that the most updated figure is now 120 million. So it has gone up by another 6 million. These are refugees, asylum seekers, internally displaced people, being forced by conflict, by persecution, by different and increasingly complex forms of violence.
The UN's new report on global trends in displacement estimates the number has only increased in the first 4 months of 2024. With conflict being a major driver of displacement. Grandi singled out the war in Sudan as one of the most catastrophic ones.
It is a crisis that, and this is not applying to you who report from here, so hear about that a lot, but generally doesn't really make it to the headline. It's a very forgotten crisis, although it's one of the most catastrophic ones, not just in terms of displacement, but in terms of hunger, lack of access, violation of human rights, and so forth.
Speaking on Gaza, Grandi cautioned that with Israel's offensive forcing around 1.7 million people into internal displacement, that's nearly 80% of the population, many of them displaced multiple times, people fleeing Israel's military operations from the southern border town of Rafah into Egypt could lead to catastrophic consequences. Especially, he says, because there's no guarantee they'll be able to return.
That's Devi Rajaram of Reuters reporting. And that's going to end today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.